Welcome to this podcast series asking the question, can art save us? I'm starting the first national and international conversation about courage and curiosity. What do these qualities really mean and why does it make a big difference to our mental, societal and democratic health? I talk to award-winning and diverse artists across the arts to explore these qualities in their lives and work, both to inspire and for us all to learn. I'm exploring why we need these qualities to help change the global epidemic of mental illness, loneliness, polarisation of our communities, and even global conflict. If the arts cultivate courage and curiosity, I'm asking the question, can art save us? My guest today has such clear purpose as an artist. If she were a stick of rock, it would be stamped all the way through her. Her values in social justice, equality and kindness feed into all of her work. She's a multi-award winning and BAFTA nominated actress. Julie Hesmond-Hausch is one of Britain's most loved actresses. She plays roles for stage and screen that tackle important issues and reach out to the hearts and minds of audiences everywhere. Her roles in drama have included sexual violence, the calamity of hate crimes, the representation of transgender people, exploring the right to die, and more recently, exposing one of the most widespread miscarriages of justice in British history, the post office scandal. In theatre, her work has responded to war, austerity, cancer, mental health, refugees, and currently her personal and emotionally courageous one-woman show, These I Love. Julie's work as an artist is part and parcel of her activism for positive change, a fairer society and equality, including access to the arts. Whilst her famous and groundbreaking television role as Hayley Cropper, a transgender woman in Coronation Street, often dominates her career, her work is evidently bigger than this very famous soap opera. Julie is also full of fun and she understands the importance of daftness. She thinks deeply about hope, what it means and how we navigate our lives. Never mind Coronation Street, Julie is right up my street and I could not be more pleased that she is joining me today. Hello, Julie.
Hello, Paula. What a lovely introduction. Cracky. That's something to live up to now, isn't it?
No pressure.
So much. That's really lovely. I feel like, let's just end it there.
Well, bless your heart. And it's only testimony to your unwavering commitment to the arts and to your values. So I'm very grateful for your time. So thank you again, Julie.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Oh, wow. No, the pleasure's mine. But Julie, I was thinking, where on earth do you start this huge career? But actually, the current theatre work is a great place to start because, of course, These I Love takes us back to the beginning, your childhood, your formative years. So I wondered if you could tell us about finding your dad's diaries and how this created These I Love.
It's very lovely for you to ask me about it, actually, because it's only a little thing, really. It's a show that I wrote quite soon after I lost my dad and quite soon after I left Coronation Street after 16 years. So what happened was in 2013, my dad died in the January, just as I announced that I was leaving Corrie. And then I filmed my last scenes in the November, and there was a little break between me filming my last scenes and then having my leaving party. So I took myself off to the Lake District, just me and the dog, because I wanted to take stock of that year and to try and get my head around these huge new changes in my life, because it had been a job that I'd loved so much for so long and had been a massive, massive part of my life. And just almost as an afterthought, really, I packed this old electric blanket box full of old notebooks and diaries that my dad had left when he died and that my mum had dug out and that I hadn't had the chance to have a look at since the funeral. So I bunged them in the car and took them up, and then I just started reading them while I was up in the lakes. And they were extraordinary, Paula. The poetry and the beauty of the soul of this young man, because the diaries went right back to when he was 15, 16 years old. My dad's mother had died when he was a baby, and his father took his own life when dad was 16, which is something we knew about but talked about very little in our house. And it was just astonishing to just feel the depth of feeling and the ability to express himself that he'd had from such a young age, even though he'd had no education, that had been thwarted. He'd got a place at grammar school and been stopped from going by his stepmother, who later disowned him and left him without a home. So it was quite an extraordinary thing. And I just read them like a great novel. I'd absolutely devoured them over these few days. And very strange experience of going back from a leaving party at Coronation Street, feeling absolutely full of joy and gratitude and courage. I felt very, very emboldened by knowing something more about his life. And so I just started to write this show. And I'm not a writer. I mean, I've written a couple of books, but they're very much to do with my idea. They're more sort of part manifesto, a little bit memoir, but this was a story that I just felt like I really wanted to tell about the childhood that my dad had managed to give to me and my brother, in spite of, not because of, his own past and the tragedy of it. And it felt like a story to tell about rising above the preordained circumstances of your life, changing the narrative of your life to give your own children a very, very different kind of upbringing to the one you've had, overcoming huge mental health problems because my dad suffered throughout his life through that, and about the healing power of daftness. That's kind of my byline for the show, because my whole childhood was about play and wordplay and making up rhymes and songs and games. And, you know, it's something that he really gave to me and my brother that really shapes my life. My dad wasn't an actor. He wasn't a performer in any sense of the word, but he certainly gave me a love of words and play and playfulness and curiosity and a love of the arts as well, which he would never have given himself any credit for, absolutely, throughout his life. So this little show was born, and I did a couple of scratch performances of it very early on. And this is the first time that I've performed it as an actual show. Because Lossie at Bolton Octagon and Jack at Live Theatre in Newcastle coincidentally both contacted me at the same time. You know, things are very, very difficult for regional theatres at the moment. And they said, have you got anything that you could bring just for a few days, just to bring audiences in? And I said, well, funnily enough, I do have this little show in my back pocket and I could learn it and do it. And so that's how it was. And I've got it now. So I can do it wherever, because it's, you know, it's just me and the electric blanket box full of diaries and notebooks, really. You know, that's all I need to do it. So it's been a very, very lovely thing to spend time with my dad and spend time with friends and family coming to see it and introducing it to a new audience. And it's been very, very rewarding and lovely experience.
Yeah, it does sound really wonderful, and particularly because you're really gifting your dad's voice and his values by sharing this. Wouldn't it be wonderful? Imagine him looking down and seeing this take place. But it's so defining in your life. And what stood out to me when I read about your dad's diaries was at only 16, and apparently this was only a month after his dad died in tragic circumstances, that he wrote, "A character I should like to have." And I wondered if you might want to just share a little bit more on that. I found it really outstanding, the maturity of his young voice, particularly a voice that has gone through quite disadvantage in terms of, you know, the kind of cruel actions from a stepmom, as one example, and such tragic loss with his dad. I wondered if you might want to talk about the impact of that alone, a character I should have, because it seems so defining in your own life.
Yeah, I mean, it was the second piece I read, because I read the diaries in no order. I just read them randomly. And that was the second piece that I stumbled across when he was, and he'd written it when he was 16, 2 months actually after his dad's death. And it's like a little manifesto for life. So he talks about being pleasant and smiling and friendly to everyone worthy of friendship. You know, he's not over sentimental in it. You know, he acknowledges that there are people that aren't worthy of your time and friendship and energy sometimes, you know, but to give everyone a chance. But the overriding thing in it, which I think is very relevant and pertinent to your podcast, Paula, is that he talks about using the words and music of great minds, great artists, to pull himself out of the abyss, to find meaning in his life. And he did that throughout his life. He loved the war poetry of Rupert Brooke. He loved the novels of Graham Greene. He loved anything by Chopin. I mean, how he'd found access to these things, I have absolutely no idea. When he left school at 14 and became a butcher's boy, and when he did national service, he joined the classical music listening group, which was entirely populated by officers. He was the only private in it. You know, he sort of, there was something in him, a yearning to find meaning in his own life and to find solace in his own life. And the two great loves of his life that helped him to do that, and this was the thing that he discovered at 16, were music, poetry, the written word, and nature. He felt very close to God, what he defined as God, out in the open air, and those things carried him through absolutely to the end of his life. And I think saved his life. You know, he returned over and over again to art to pull him out of those very, very dark places. And he taught me and my brother to do the same.
Yeah. Yeah, it must be so fundamental as a guiding force in your own life. And also, I know that sadly, when dementia affected him, you've spoken about how poetry and music continued to be really important, its role in well-being, in healing, in calming. And I'm very interested in your point of view on that important relationship we can have with the arts in terms of our health and well-being, because do you see direct harm happening in the absence of arts that's increasingly happening in our society after over a decade of cuts?
100%, 100% I do. I find it incredibly alarming, actually, because my dad, you know, grew up, this was, you know, pre-National Health Service. It was pre that amazing post-war movement that was about giving working class people a better life and education and access to stuff. You know, that incredible thing that happened after World War II, you know, that excitement and energy towards making life better. You know, he was finding these things before that, but everything, it seems to me, that happened in that movement has been taken away now. So constantly when I'm in rehearsal rooms or on set, I'm working with people of all different ages who would not be there were it not for various state-sanctioned access programs to art, whether so older people that have might have been night school or some kind of youth theatre or amateur company, and with younger people, just that wonderful period where art became quite central to learning. In the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, there's so many people who were unacademic, were struggling at school, who were the class joker or whatever. We've heard the story a million times before, haven't we? Who just excelled in either art or music or drama, and who went on to do great things in those areas. And, you know, I'm very involved in Arts Emergency, which is an absolutely wonderful organisation that I'm sure you're aware of, Paula.
Yeah, big shout out for Arts Emergency.
Oh, I mean, they are amazing. And, you know, there are lots and lots of groups now that are desperately scrambling to fill the gap now that has been left by this pulling of arts funding across the board in schools and beyond. And they, you know, they've always said that their purpose was to create an old boys network for those who don't have it. You know, they started off by looking at that very famous, often banned photograph of all the Etonians that, you know, included Boris Johnson and George Osborne and David Cameron.
You're giving me nightmares now, Julie.
I know. Sorry. We'll have to put a trigger warning at the beginning of this, obviously. It's like, if anyone hasn't seen that photograph, think yourself lucky. But with that picture, and they said, how can we create that kind of thing? You know, it's hard not to feel that it's a conspiracy when you hear about the millions that a school like Eton pours into its arts education every year. You know, I think they've got like three different theatre spaces. They've got an artistic director that works there full time. They've got full time staff. I have friends who went to Eton whose musical ability was nurtured throughout. You know, the arts is absolute front and centre of a life at Eton and at other public schools, I'm sure. But I know for a fact at Eton it is, where a lot of, obviously, our previous governments have been. And I don't think it's because they are keen to create the next generation of actors and musicians. It's because they know that an arts education gives people self-worth, self-confidence, communication skills, problem-solving skills, all the things that matter when you are trying to train up the next leaders of your country. And it's hard not to feel like it's a conspiracy when that arts funding increases year on year while it's being cut back year on year in state education, and right down to the EBAC, which is an absolute scandal. That the EBAC is this, you know, the way that we teach in schools now, and there is a humanities subject and English and maths, and art is an add-on. It's an extra to that. It's not seen as an essential subject at state education. So all those young people who might have found themselves excelling in those things, you know, Arts Emergency's motto is you can't be what you can't see. Somebody doesn't give you a script and say, right, try this. If somebody doesn't put a trumpet in your hand, try that. If somebody doesn't put a pencil in your hand and say, sketch this, then you might never know that you're the next great artist, musician, actor. But even if you're not going to be the next great one of those things, it gives you a sense of belonging in the world. It gives you purpose. It gives you mindfulness. It gives you flow. It's, you know, over and over again, it's been studied and proven that it improves mental health in young people, in all people. It's an essential part of the way that we live, and we are absolutely blocking the road to that happiness and well-being and contentment and good mental health to a massive swathe of the population, the majority of the population. And I always call myself state privileged because, you know, I went to school, I was educated, you know, I was state educated, but art and culture was very much at the heart of learning, not even as a subject, but as an extracurricular thing, and just the way that we were taught as well. We had a school orchestra, we put on plays constantly, we had an amazing and well-resourced art department and music departments. My children were part of a Tameside music scheme where every single child in our very deprived borough was given the opportunity to learn a musical instrument, and then once a year would go to the Bridgewater Hall in Manchester and play with the Halle Orchestra. And I know that several people went on to go to the Royal College of Music and the Royal Northern College of Music to study after that. And they would never have done that if someone hadn't given them a cornet, you know, or a violin. And it's, and that's been cut since, obviously, it's been cut. You know, local authorities can't afford to be doing that now. So I absolutely see it at every single level, the decimation of art in our culture and this cultural notion that it is a playground for the wealthy and that it is not for the likes of us. And it's just a tragedy. And I think that we're going to see year on year a real struggle for the mental health of this generation coming through now. And it's, and you know, people are doing their best. They're setting up youth programs and youth theatres and orchestras and bands and it, but it's very, very difficult. And even if you manage to be one of the lucky ones to go and study any of the arts at higher education, after that, it becomes impossible, you know, because I set up a theatre company with a group of friends in London. We signed on, we claimed housing benefit. All the bands in the 90s did that, you know, they just messed around with their mates and like formed a band and started doing small gigs. And there's not the time or space or money to do that now. So even that has been taken away. So it's an absolute travesty what is going on, and I hope that an incoming government will do something to change that.
Yeah, the crisis, the level of crisis in the UK, let alone globally, it is catastrophic, and it's very hard, isn't it, to not be able to see how cultural deprivation on this scale, subjects ripped out of schools, degrees disappearing, entire campuses closing down.
Yes.
How can this not be deepening the class system, the class divide? And we're met with all these rubbishy, ludicrous, yet more slogans. Leveling up. Are you having me on? So for me, and a motivation for the importance of the research in this series is the fact that the arts are very core to our democracy and our democratic rights. And I'm very concerned that the arts are actually less and less understood because of these deprivations as being core to our democratic rights. I consider it sinister, or is that extreme?
No, it's like I say, I it's hard not to feel like it's a conspiracy when it's so laid out like that. That why are public schools putting so much money into the arts? Why do they see that it is important for their children to have that arts education? Why is it central to learning? And it's not seen as central to learning in state schools. How can you not see that as sinister? We do not want this. The people in power do not want an educated, confident, mentally well, communicative, erudite, cultural working class. Of course they don't. Of course they don't. Because what will that mean? It will mean that we'll be able to take space and take up room in places that they want to be exclusively theirs. You know, and we can see it, you know, the people who run television now are all part of that. You know, they are all benefactors. They've benefited from that post-war movement that have given equal opportunities to people in the arts, and that is now being taken away. And I think moving forward, if the people that are in charge of the telling of stories are from one very narrow swathe of society, which of course is the top swathe, then we're not going to have stories about us and for us. And how will we make sense of our world then if we have no power in the arts, if we're not in positions where we can be writing those stories or producing them or directing them? You know, it's going to be, moving forward, that is going to be a very, very difficult time, I think. And even if you're a very well-meaning, privately educated, privileged person in that position of power, there will be a discomfort and a lack of confidence in telling those stories because they won't be from us and of them, you know. And there will always be those things because there'll be people breaking through. But you'll have to be extraordinary to do that. You know, I think this is what we have. It's like if you show an extraordinary talent in something and you are from extreme poverty, hopefully there'll be somebody there to push you through that. But for everybody else who's just finding their way, you know, there's just nothing. There's absolutely nothing.
Yeah, the chances aren't fair and the access is really no longer there. And this is a critical question you consistently raise and motivates your choices in terms of roles you invest in. And it's simply asking, who will tell our stories? It goes back to the democratic role of the arts. And of course, a huge current example of that is the post office scandal, the drama. And you've had a wonderful lead role in this huge ITV hit series. I wondered if you'd like to share with the listeners, you know, your experience of being part of that production. And in terms of course, it being an example of art and power, the fact that it's a drama that has mobilized more action in a massive scandal 20 years plus later.
Yeah, I mean, it has been, in one way, it's been absolutely incredible. And in another way, it's been no surprise at all. So it was interesting. You know, we were all the actors, all the creatives, everybody involved in Mr. Bates versus the Post Office was incredibly invested in the story and telling that story well. It had been very difficult to make by all accounts because television is all about making money now. You know, it speaks the language of capitalism like a lot of art does now, and they didn't think it'd sell in America. So it was very difficult to get it made. And it has been sold to America now, I'm told. So everybody did it cut price. You know, obviously, when I say cut price, we all got paid very handsomely, but compared to what one normally would be paid in television, everybody, it was a project born out of passion, for sure, from the producers and everyone involved. And we hoped it would make a difference, but we had absolutely no sense of the scale of it. Because it's a mysterious thing how these things happen. You know, sometimes something just comes out at exactly the right moment and captures the public imagination. And I think that there was something about this period where we are all at peak lies and corruption. We are all just up to our eyes in it. And there was something about this drama in its cozy ITV-ness that made people go, that's enough. That is enough. And so we hoped it would change things. We knew it would. We know, all of us involved know, the power of art and the power of storytelling to get a message across, to create empathy, to encourage people to put themselves in somebody else's shoes. That's absolutely the business we're in, isn't it? But the scale of it was, well, I think unprecedented. I mean, for many years at least, you know, I think the last time I can remember something having this sort of impact politically was Hillsborough. And then, of course, you know, in the 60s, there were Cathy Come Home and, you know, everything that Ken Loach has ever done, really. But again, on a much smaller scale more recently. So, yeah, it was an incredible thing to be part of it. And the big question that everybody was asking, you know, so in the first week, everyone sort of started watching it and said, oh, yeah, this is good. This is interesting. I knew a little bit about this. I didn't know the ins and outs of it. And then it built over that week. And by the second week after it had been broadcast, we were all being invited to speak on all the major news channels. It was very intimidating. So we were on, you know, World at One and Andrew Marr and the question they were asking us, because of course we're just actors, you know, so it's not like we were even part of the creating of it. It was like, why has it taken an ITV drama to make things move politically? And it is exactly that. It is because we, as a nation, sat down in the first week of the new year and seeing it condensed, that 20-year scandal, into 4 episodes where you could so clearly put yourself in those people's shoes. I mean, not a single person could have watched Monica Dolan surrounded by receipts, pulling her hair out on the phone to the helpline and not imagine what that must have felt like as that debt doubled in front of her eyes as she was on the phone, or Will Mellor standing in court with all his faith in the British justice system. I'll just tell the truth. I'll just go and tell the truth and they'll understand. And then being told he has to pay £300,000 court costs. You know, we all know how that must feel. And also the sort of vilification of all those people in their own communities because there was no talking about it on a grand scale. I mean, I have to say that, you know, one thing that I keep talking about subsequently that wasn't really talked about much in the drama was that had there been a proper union as opposed to this sort of quasi union that is the Federation that were completely in the bosses' pockets, if there'd been a proper union, this scandal would have been over in a week. You know, a proper union would have said, our members are all saying they're having problems with this new computer system and the debt is doubling in front of their eyes, and it would have been stopped, you know. So it's a good advert for being unionised as well, I think. But it was amazing.
Yeah, and I think your point about the union is actually another example of having voice. So we're talking about the arts and drama giving voice, and on a very practical level, a union gives voice. And again, it goes back to what do we understand a democracy to be? And surely that is having voice, all of us having voice, all of us being represented. I'll just quickly interject, Julie, because I'm lucky enough to have international listeners. So just in case people aren't familiar with the post office scandal, I'll just recap that this is a huge miscarriage of justice because the post office wrongly accused and prosecuted hundreds of innocent sub-postmasters for theft and fraud or false accounting. This actually resulted in criminal convictions, people going to jail. There is the horrifying reality of linked suicides, bankruptcy, families failing, health failing. It's an absolute travesty. But the scandal continues because of the outrageous delay in compensation or redress of this financial scandal. So I just wanted to give some of the other listeners context, should they not be familiar.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a real David and Goliath story of ordinary people being absolutely done over by a business that had absolutely no regard at all for its workers, but more than that, absolutely threw them under the bus to save their brand. It was all about brand. I mean, you know, when you're watching it, you're just like, why? Why didn't they just say at some point, yes, we've made a mistake? It's like, it's unbelievable how sinister it's been. And I think it's, as I say, I think it just highlights the fact that it can happen. Because I think that we have become a little bit inured to corruption. You know, we've lived through such unbelievable times over the last few years. The scandals come and scandals go and they don't affect us in the same way anymore because we're so used to it. It's become so normalised that politicians and people in power and the establishment lie and cheat and disrespect and I mean, just ordinary people. Just it's terrible. So I feel the proudest thing about this is that it has mobilised people. And people didn't let it go. You know, people were just like, what is happening about this now? And it's been incredibly vindicating for the victims, those who are still here to be vindicated, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it really begs the question, doesn't it? Why does the current government not only disproportionately and relentlessly cut the arts, why do they also label arts subjects as soft and low value? And I think we really need to address the prejudice of this language and these choices when we start to relate how the arts not only support health, well-being, social cohesion, but again, going back to democracy and issues of social justice. Imagine if this particular drama hadn't been made. Presumably, the scandal would continue to be buried.
Yeah, it would absolutely. I mean, you know, I don't want to underplay the incredible investigative journalism and campaigning journalism that has gone on for the 20 years. You know, Nick Wallace, who made the BBC podcast about the scandal, has been, you know, really, really key in this, as has Private Eye, as has Computer Weekly. You know, they were doing this work for years. And without their work, the drama wouldn't have been made. You know, it's really important to acknowledge that. But sometimes it takes, you know, that tool of empathy, storytelling, to really, really make people understand something. You know, and to see people, to see a person going through something in real time, it is often more effective than any number of news articles, podcasts, TV documentaries. You know, it is an incredible, important tool for creating social change. And storytelling is something that we've done since time began. You know, it's part of us, isn't it, to do that. And so, yeah, the decrying of it as a soft subject is just, I mean, it's just madness, isn't it? It is just absolute madness. I mean, somebody from Arts Emergency, Neil, who runs Arts Emergency, said that recently someone had taken him to task about using the language of capitalism to talk about art. And I've really taken that on board, actually, because you hear constantly people talking, people in the arts talking about it in economic terms. And there is no getting away from it, you know. The cultural industries in this country are one of the only burgeoning industries left. It brings in 1.4, I think, billion pounds a year. It is what we do best. You know, we're world leaders in art and culture, from theatre to opera to television to film. All those things cannot be argued with. But sometimes we fall back on talking in that language in order to justify what we do and to try and persuade people that it isn't a soft subject, that it is worth studying, that it is worth taking a career in. But actually, beyond that, way beyond that, is the stuff that you're talking about, Paula, which is about how crucial it is and how absolutely embedded in us, it is to tell stories in order to make sense of things, to solve problems, to combat prejudice. You know, for many, many years, I played a trans character in Coronation Street, and it changed things. And I saw the changes that happened for trans people at that point. Now, I would never play that part now. You know, it was a very different time. It was the late 90s. I was cast as a cisgender person in that role. But ordinary people watching Coronation Street saw this character, liked her, and more than that, really, really got behind a relationship with this shy cafe owner. And that role was written as a joke. I didn't know that. But this magical thing happened, like it happened with the post office, where this huge, huge number of the population tuned in and really, really wanted this relationship between Roy and Hayley to work. And I would be stopped in the street and people would say, when are Roy and Hayley getting married? And I'd say, well, we're not allowed to get married, because at that point it was against the law for trans people to marry their partners. And they would say, oh, never mind that, never mind that. And that's how you change the world, you know, because if you have a prejudice against someone, if something is an issue and you don't understand it, and you're fearful of it in some way, that's where hatred starts, that's where division starts. But if you have somebody in your living room four times a week and you're rooting for them, that's how you start to unpick prejudice. And I saw that happen. I saw that happen when I was in Coronation Street. I saw the law changing and us being thanked as a TV programme for creating this cultural change that contributed to that movement towards the acceptance of trans people and the law being changed in their favour. I mean, things are very, very difficult for trans people again now, but back then there was this moment of things shifting culturally and politically for trans people. And I've seen it for myself. I've seen it too many times now to not be an absolute advocate for art changing lives and contributing towards the change of policy and attitudes in our society. And so for us still to be having to defend the arts as not a soft subject, as crucial, as important, as central as it is to us all, seems absolutely bonkers to me.
Yeah, yeah. The example of Hayley and Roy is just so significant. The compassion engendered through probably one of the greatest screen love stories in history, I think we could say in many ways, you know, in such a famous soap opera, you know, right up there with all the big cinematic love stories. I have to admit, I could not bring myself to watch the final scene, Hayley's end of life scene, because that love story was so huge. But isn't it fantastic? This is such an important example of how the arts, taking this example of the performing arts, helps people project, it helps remove barriers. People simply focused on the humanity of those two people and their love for each other. And this is, of course, something that I think it's fair to say motivates all of your work behind Take Back Theatre, which you might like to talk about, because you've emphasised through that work. In fact, I'll quote you, Julie. You're talking about the importance of drama because it's asking people simply to do what good art has always required of us, to place ourselves firmly in the shoes of another.
Yeah, absolutely that. Well, we set up Take Back, me and Rebecca Harrison and Grant Archer, back in 2015, I think it was. The Conservative Party conference was in Manchester, and we wanted to create an evening of theatre that asked questions about policy. And it was a really successful evening, and we decided to create something more long term, where we would make immediate responses of short script in hand pieces to social and political events, which sounds a bit dry, and they're never dry events. They're absolutely amazing. And we've thought long and hard over the years about what we're doing, because you really question yourself, I think, as an artist and as a theatre company, when it is clear that you are preaching to the converted. You know, we did an evening on the night of Trump's inauguration, and we did a show called Take Back America in Manchester. And we had loads and loads of amazing writers writing short pieces and fantastic actors performing them. And you know, it was clear, you know, there wasn't going to be somebody in a MAGA hat stumbling upon that evening and being like, and the scales falling from their eyes and going like, oh, actually, yes, you know, I maybe shouldn't have voted for Donald Trump. That is not the purpose of what we do. There is much division now in our society. And this is what I mean about the sort of like that movement that followed the post office drama. There was a sort of togetherness about it. I think that people took real comfort in it being an issue that everybody, it seemed, across all political persuasions could see the absolute wrongness of what had gone on with the way that the post office had treated its workers over so many years. And there was a real comfort in everybody agreeing on that. You know, we were very united on that issue, and in a world that feels very, very divided a lot of the time now. And what we aim to do with Takeback is we ask questions about an issue that's going on. We try to start conversations, but we're also about emboldening people. And I think about it as like church, really. You know, people go to church not to be converted. They go to church to feel a sense of community and a sense of fellowship and a sense of having your faith in what you believe in reinforced and feeling sure of yourself as you leave. I assume that's how people feel when they've left church. And that's, I think, what we do with Take Back. We have created a place where artists and audiences who feel a little bit in the political wilderness at the moment, and they find a place that is very, very different from sitting behind your computer screen or your phone screen at home, feeling very, very isolated and at odds with the world, because everything can seem very, very difficult and combative. And it creates a place where people can watch and listen and then have great conversations in the bar afterwards and then leave feeling much less alone in perhaps their feelings about how they would like the world to be. And I think that we do that very, very successfully, actually. We're at a point now where we're doing different things with our work. So we're doing much more kind of immersive and installation-based work around very specific issues like the refugee crisis. It's been a thing that has given me probably more joy than any other artistic pursuit that I've had in the last few years, because we put them together, these evenings, in quite quickly and with very little stress these days. I mean, that's hilarious because it's always stressful just before, but because there's scripts in hand, we can get great people to come along and just rehearse in the day and then put it on at night. And we have created this little community of people in Manchester, well, a growing community of people in Manchester, who occupy what I always talk about as being the middle bit of the Venn diagram, which is between being an artist and an activist, and finding a place for us there and a community there. And that has felt just wonderful for me.
Yeah, it does seem that Take Back Theatre is a brilliant example of why we need cultural spaces. And what you're describing is enabling a space for connection. We're talking about social cohesion, ways of exploring, exercising healthy curiosity and understanding. What I'm curious about is actually going back to courage. We touched on courage early on in the interview, particularly in relation to your dad's stories as a young boy and his experiences. But courage clearly travels through who you are. And I think sometimes it's very easy to think artists are simply artists. We kind of maybe don't remember to think about the degree of challenges and courage that's required for artists to fulfill their roles in all sorts of different ways. So actors, for example, have real responsibility around representation. And you're not shy of hard choices. So if I was to highlight Broadchurch, for example, where you take the role of a woman who's subject to sexual violence and rape, and also Black Roses, which obviously is the true story of the brutal and horrific murder of Sophie Lancaster, an example of hate crimes. You're not shy of very, very difficult roles. I'm interested, Julie, on how you would explain perhaps your artistic and personal courage. Is it the necessity of honouring your beliefs?
Well, I don't feel courageous at all. I mean, I feel like I am constantly in a position of, I don't know, just feeling like I don't do or say enough, and that I can be very, very frightened actually of saying the wrong thing. I don't like creating division. I don't like being part of fallings out about things, you know. So I've had some very, very difficult moments with myself recently about how much to say or not to say about the conflict in Gaza. I know that as a public figure, I have a responsibility to stand side by side with people who are suffering. And I found that a very, very difficult line to walk, you know. And I felt very challenged by my own feelings of not wanting to upset certain people. And yeah, it's been a time of great personal difficulty for me in that. And when I say that, obviously, you know, compared to people who were going through horrendous things there, I'm not comparing it to that at all, but it is that sort of that point at which when to speak, when not to speak, what your role is, how you're most useful. You know, I feel like I do... I'm good at bringing people together in some ways, and I don't want to lose that capacity. And so, yeah, so it's interesting you talk about courage at a time when I'm very, very much questioning my own courage and ability to put my head above the parapet at the moment, Paula. And in terms of the roles that I get and do, I just think that I've just been incredibly fortunate. I will give myself credit in saying that I know that people trust me to bring integrity to what I do, that I won't just go and like take the money and run. I know that if I'm playing somebody who is a survivor of rape and sexual violence, I know that the people that are employing me know that I'll be able to talk about that, that I will do my research, that I will talk to people, and that I will do my absolute best to represent the group of people that I'm representing. The same with Hayley and the trans issue. You know, a lot of people had an issue even back then with me as a cisgendered person playing that role. And I felt really certain that it was the right thing then, that it would have been unbelievable pressure for a trans actor, because there were so few then, and the press would have gone for them in such a way that I felt really sure that I would represent them with integrity and really, really try to be a spokesperson for them in the best possible way. And that... you know, it comes with it, you know, and some actors are really, really happy just to play the role and not take on that role as somebody who talks about it and around the issue. But I know that that is something that I can bring to the table. And so I think that that's possibly why I get a lot of these roles. I'm just about to start a job in Nottingham that's about restorative justice. And, you know, and that's something I'm really, really interested in, this idea of forgiveness and the idea of like how we can help people who've done terrible things to change their lives and what role we have in that. And And again, I feel like, oh, amazing that I've been given this chance to play something that I can really delve into that issue, something that I've not looked at deeply before and read around and talk about and meet the people involved. And so I do feel very fortunate that I've been put in that position over and over again. So it doesn't feel like courage at all. It feels like privilege. And I am careful. You know, when I got the role in Broadchurch, I didn't know Chris Chibnall, who was the creator of it then. And I didn't know what the story was going to be. And I did ask, you know, so it wasn't like, I'll give myself credit in that I didn't just go like, ooh, Broadchurch, big hits, I'm in it. You know, I wouldn't have taken the role if I'd, in the questions that I asked very early on when they offered me the part, if it was going to turn out that she lied or, you know, that it was going to be a story that was very much about the perpetrator of that crime rather than the survivor of it, I wouldn't have taken it. You know, I don't want to be part of something that feeds into a difficult narrative of the way that we tell these stories. So I am prepared to say no to things. I think sometimes you can show more courage in doing that. And again, I'm very lucky because I'm financially secure because of the work that I've done. You know, there are people who are so brave in saying no to things when a part might be life changing for them in terms of security and stuff. And you know, it's them that should be applauded for that. I think sometimes it's the saying no that you never see or hear about that is the real brave choice.
Yeah, everything you've just said really relates to the importance of integrity, the relationship of integrity to courage and to making the right choices. It's something other guests have raised. In fact, Basil Watson, who's a world-leading sculptor, I was lucky enough to interview, he's responsible for the Windrush Memorial at London's Waterloo Station. And his emphasis is very much on integrity and making the right choices, however small that choice may be or comparatively small in the world. It's about making the right choice. And sometimes we have to be very courageous to make the right choice.
Yeah, we do. And I think sometimes we have to be really, you know, we have to be really honest with ourselves. And I think sometimes we have to allow ourselves cowardice. You know, we have to allow ourselves to be fearful, and we have to be, you know, I think that as long as there is thoughtfulness in the choices that you make, you know, it's okay to make mistakes too. It's all right to get it wrong. It is all right to get it wrong. And it's and that is the hardest thing, you know, because when you're a public person, you know, that you're being watched in those choices that you make and the way that you choose to use your voice, and whether it's through your work or the way you talk around the work or just as a public figure, you know. And I think it's I think that people can be very fearful of things. And actually, I don't know if I've not got jobs because of my stance politically on things. I don't know that. I know that I've got jobs because of it. So, you know, it's worth being true to yourself as much as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. It does seem important to be clear about your own motivation, doesn't it, to sort of justify your own decision making. And it's interesting your emphasis on the fact that people can be made to feel very fearful. There's lots of reasons to be fearful in our lives. But that brings me to a really important conversation you've raised, which is about being curious about what hope is and the importance of understanding and exploring what hope is. I wondered if you'd like to share some thoughts on that.
Well, hope is something that Take Back, our theatre company, return to over and over again, you know, and it's And it's a very difficult and slippery thing, this hope, isn't it? Because there have been times recently where I have felt myself lacking in hope and thinking, oh, you know, things feel really tough, you know, socially, politically, globally. I can't remember a time when things have felt quite so far along in the scale of bleakness, you know, in a lot of ways. But again, going back to Arts Emergency, they have a wonderful motto that's a little badge that they have, which is optimism is our superpower. It is completely in those who run the world's interest for us to be hopeless and bleak and feel that we have no power to change anything and that the way things are is the way things are, and nothing that little old us can ever do will change that. And that is an incredibly strong position for the establishment to be in, for us to feel like they have a population that just feels like, well, it's just awful, isn't it? It's just all so awful and there's nothing that we can do. And I think that it is our duty, our absolute duty, to remain hopeful and to remain optimistic and to remember that the world comes in epochs, life comes in epochs, things are terrible and then they get better. We have gone through huge, absolutely enormous cultural and societal changes over the last few years, the last few decades, and the last few centuries, and things always change. And we have to remember how powerful we are. You know, the public outcry over the post office scandal because of just that one little four-part ITV drama is changing things. When we choose to put our voices together, it is no coincidence that this government at the moment is coming down hard on protest, because our young people are coming out in their thousands to say enough is enough. Enough is enough with food poverty, with climate change, with arms sales to countries who are wholesale bombing innocent people. We are coming out in our droves, led by our young people, our passionate, amazing young people. And you'll see them decried. You will see them called hate mongers, your terrorist sympathisers, thugs, middle class poshies with nothing else better to do. They'll throw everything at them. To me, that can only be a good sign that they are absolutely terrified of this next generation and what they are capable of, because, you know, people have done amazing things. They have brought down the Berlin Wall. They've ended apartheid in South Africa. Change never, ever comes from above. The status quo will always remain the status quo because the people in power want it to be so, until we as people say enough is enough. And we have always had the power to do that. It comes in waves and it comes in, you know, just there's always a tipping point and then things change. And you've just got to remember that and keep hold of that and go, yeah, there have been so many things that have seemed outside anything we could imagine. You know, only a few short decades ago, we were dealing with Section 28, and then gay marriage came, bang, overnight, it seemed, you know, things that seemed so outside the Overton window of what could be possible in our world suddenly becomes possible and normalised because of ordinary people at the coalface of change working every day to make things happen. You know, people standing outside embassies, demonstrating for years and years and years, thinking nothing is changing. Every single action that anybody takes is part of that movement to change things. And we mustn't ever let the powers that be make us feel that we're useless, alone, powerless, incompetent, impotent, any of those things, because together we're more powerful than they dare to even imagine. And that's where I find my hope, and that's where I find my optimism. And I think that it is our absolute duty to keep that and to keep passing that on.
Yeah, and such an important reminder that every act, every seed matters. And talking of protest and increased infringements on our rights to protest, again, going back to questions of democracy, our democratic rights, needing to start questioning our democratic rights being changed or compromised. But also, it's interesting when you think about hope and also joy as an act of rebellion or an act of protest against fear and despair. And would you say that's where, again, we can go to the arts to find joy, to find hope, that the arts can cultivate those qualities that may help us rise up to the better lives and the fairer world that we want to exist in?
100%. That's absolutely part of a massive part of what art does, isn't it? Is to give us pleasure, to give us joy, to bring us together, to experience things in the same room together, you know, whether that's a film or a play or an opera or a dance piece or a gig, you know, that is absolutely what it is. It's about community and joy and happiness, and absolutely that is art's main purpose, you know. And what kind of a world would we live in without those things, you know? And you know, the way that we're constantly told that those things don't relate to us, that they're just nothing to do with us, when, you know, every single person experiences art in some form or other every day and finds some sort of solace or joy or comfort from it. That is exactly it, Paula. That is exactly it. And, you know, there's a wonderful book called Radical Happiness by Lindsay Gall, who's a wonderful writer and activist, and it's about exactly that. It's about the joy of movements, of being part of things, you know, and working towards change together. And I think that is why Take Back, and working in the different places that I've worked where I've been able to combine art and activism, gives me so much joy and purpose, because, you know, those are the two things that make the world go round, as far as I'm concerned. They're my two great passions, and being able to have the huge privilege of being able to combine those two things, you know, more than most people get the chance to, has been the great honour of my life.
Yeah, absolutely. Struggle really has to meet hope and joy as part of perseverance, it seems to me. Even very recently, you may be aware, I'm not sure if it may even affect Take Back Theatre as one example, but the Arts Council was in a controversy very recently because they had, they had used language to say, or to really deliver a clear warning that being overtly political, artists, arts organisations, could lead to risks of funding withdrawal. So, of course, that would inevitably lead to uproar. Again, it's compromising your democratic rights. They've since updated this statement. They've said that was open to misinterpretation. Was it?
Well, they need to get better copywriters then, don't they? Because it was pretty clear to me what it meant. It was absolutely, so shocking, so shocking. But that's the culture we're in now. That's the culture we're in. You're not allowed to say anything without sort of putting over the other opposing point of view in a fair and balanced way. That is not what conversation is. You know, it just isn't. It's like, Avril Hirsch said she was on, she was being interviewed, you know, she'd written the brilliant, brilliant book, British, about racism in Britain. And she said that it had got to the point where she was going on to programmes to debate racism with a racist. And she was like, there is no opposing view to racism that you need to get someone on to put the other point of view for balance. It's like, she said, that's like getting a survivor of rape on and then going like, well, we better get a rapist in as well just to get their point of view. You know, sometimes it doesn't work like that. You know, we have to speak truth to power. We have to be able to make the people in power accountable for their actions. And my God, their actions need taken into account in these last few years in particular. And so for us, after every time we make a statement about something that is being done to us, to our democratic rights, to our freedoms, to our ability to survive, to our rights to proper benefits and welfare and education and health. If you say anything about those things, that you have to sort of like have a kind of artistic version of a comment from the government in it, it's just absolutely crackers and the death of art, actually. And so, yeah, again, you know, people just were in uproar and they've had to take a step back from that statement, but it was really clear what they meant, because they're scared about getting their funding cut by a government that doesn't value what they do. Yeah. It all comes back to that.
Yeah, it was absolutely shocking, because also misinterpretation, certainly not ours, shouldn't have been in any way a possibility. It seems, I'm horribly conscious of how fast time goes, that I should probably move to the end question, the series question, in view of everything we've said, and we've probably answered in lots of different ways. But can art save us?
Can art save us? It's really hard, isn't it? Because I'm such an evangelist for art. I am such an evangelist generally, I think, that my complete instinct is to say, yes, of course it can. I think that to say it that way is problematic. I think that art is part, a huge and important part of the way that helping us to understand the world that we live in and to encourage us to change the circumstances of our lives and the lives of those around us. I think that it absolutely enables us to find joy in darkness, light in darkness. I think that it increases our well-being and our good mental health. Whether it saves us is a different matter, but it certainly contributes to pulling us out of the abyss. That's what I'd say.
Yeah, and actually, a quote of yours I have, which I think probably complements what you're saying, is a culture without diversity will be a sick one.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is what an art is about, absolutely representing us, showing us the grey areas, the difficult grey areas. This is where we have our most important conversations about the world, as well as finding joy and happiness. Yeah, it would be a very bleak world without art, and it would also be a very black and white world, and that is never a good thing.
No, not at all. And I think maybe a nice way of summarising and saying thank you for your time today is picking up on one of your books, An Actor's Alphabet, and the actress, another outstanding actress, and a big shout out to Maxine Peake.
Yeah.
Is her review, like its author, Julie Hesmondhausch, this book is brimming with wisdom, intelligence, empathy and humanity, an absolute must. And it struck me An Actor's Alphabet could perhaps read as an alphabet for life.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. Thank you, Paula. I mean, I wrote it, you know, as it is a book for actors primarily, but as I've said to lots of people, I hope that it has something beyond that about the way that we look at the world and and the place of art and artists in our world and our society, and also a bit of a manifesto for the way that I would like to live ideally, and you know, I hope that people can get something of that from it too.
Yeah, thank you. And listeners, I will be signposting on Julie's episode page links to Arts Emergency and also links to Take Back Theatre, and I will pop on anything else Julie may suggest to me. I don't want to say goodbye, Julie. You're my favourite stick of rock, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you for all you do. What a brilliant podcast it is. Thank you.